I grew up playing the modern flute like most flutists. In fact, I think that's probably the preferred route to some of these early flutes, is really to start the music with the music of the day and the music that you grew up with. But then, right after college, I had two experiences that pertain to early music and early flutes. I teamed up with a fellow in Seattle, George Shangro, with whom I did many Baroque concerts. We called them an evening, a candlelight evening of Baroque music for flute and harpsichord, or that sort of thing, and with lots of candles and flowers. And we did all kinds of Baroque music, and played mostly in the Northwest, but we've since done a couple of tours in Europe. I guess we've been there together three times. And have also done a lot of other music, and maybe, I don't know if any of you were here last summer, George came up with me also with a composer from Seattle who's written three beautiful full-length flute sonatas for us. In fact, we're working on one right now that's never been played, and I happen to bring one movement of it, and Jerry and I are going to give a world premiere tomorrow night of a movement of this flute sonata by Bob Keckley, who's also a composer in residence at a church in Seattle. That was one thing that, although I had been interested in Baroque music before that, certainly, and still to this day, in spite of my experience with the early instruments, I love playing Baroque music on modern flute. It's the instrument of the day, and it's certainly very different from the sound they knew in those days. In fact, it's alien to the kind of hearing that they had in those days. But it's admittedly different, but it's not different for us. It's has very distinct qualities of its own. Anyway, and another experience was, there was a festival in Seattle. The ASEA, the American Society for Eastern Arts, had a festival every year. I don't know if they still do, in Berkeley. They had it in Seattle that summer, and they brought in teachers of all kinds of instruments from Eastern lands, from India and China and Indonesia. They had gamelan. And also teachers of dance. There was a wonderful Indian dancer, and this took place in Seattle for 9 weeks, and during that time I studied the Japanese shakuhachi, which is a very simple Japanese instrument, just with five finger holes, one for the thumb and four other holes. And also I studied the South Indian flute, from the East Indian flute, which is a small flute, much like this Renaissance flute. But it has much larger holes, because with the Indian music it's very important to approximate vocal kinds of effects. So with the large holes you can slide on and off and make these beautiful vocal slides and ornaments. Well, I took to these flutes, these simple flutes, although in reality a flute like this with many fewer holes and much less of a contraption than its modern counterpart is, in a way, more complicated to they're more complicated to make. There's a lot more craftsmanship involved, because if I were to strip this of its keys, you would see just a silver tube with a bunch of holes of equal size. Actually, down here, the holes are a little bit bigger, but for the most part, the holes are of the same size, and they just have a little chimney that comes out, and it's all machine worked. And most of the people, or many of the people, that work in the factories that make these, although there are many craftsmen still that make, say, 20 a year by themselves. But this is a Haynes flute that was made in Boston by 25 people, one of them punching the holes and one of them rolling out the silver and so on. But here there are many, many little decisions that have to be made. This particular Renaissance flute is a copy of five that are in Verona. A friend of mine made most of these, Rudolf Toots. I don't know quite how to say it because in German it's something in between, Toots. It's between Toots and Toots, but each have meaning to me with regard to my friend Rudy, who makes flutes. He makes things that toot, and he's a toots to me. He's a good friend. Anyway, there were five of these in a museum, and to have five instruments that are that old, from the 16th century, all lined up next to one another is a very rare thing. You know, generally, you'll have... for instance, of these flutes from 150 years later than this, say roughly 1700, there are about five or seven of them by Hotteterr spread around the world. But there's one in Leningrad, there's one, this particular one that this is a copy of is in Graz in Austria, and there's one in Paris and one in St. Moritz in a little museum in Switzerland. But to have five of these together is quite something. Anyway, so... with five of them together, I could see what details they stuck to precisely, what things were exactly the same as, you know, Haynes flutes would be all pretty much exactly the same from the factory, and what other things were different. Some of them were thicker wood than others, and with a thicker or smaller chimney, as we call it right here, that you blow against, that air, that wall that you blow against, which is what makes the sound in all flutes, recorders included, except that in the case of a recorder, some of the work is done for you. The air is channeled into a little, channeled for you across that edge. Here, you blow across it. Well, if that surface that you blow against is larger or smaller, it makes a difference in the tone, or if the wood that resonates is thicker or less thicker, it makes a difference, or if the wood where the air escapes under your fingers is smaller or larger, that makes a difference too. Anyway, so depending on the thickness of the wood, you have to make other changes, and one of them is the undercutting. These aren't simply bored, but they're very precisely undercut. Certain holes are undercut more towards the top part of the tube than the bottom part of the tube, which has an effect not only in tone but in the tuning of the instrument. And obviously when you only have six holes as opposed to one for every note, which in a way makes it easy, then you have to make a lot of compromises in a flute like this. So I've come to really appreciate the art of making a simple instrument, and where that is most obvious is in the simplest of flutes, at least in the sense that it has the fewest of holes, the shakuhachi, the Japanese shakuhachi, which is so expressive and has so many different shades of color, and yet it's the flute with the fewest number of holes, and a professional player playing a shakuhachi will spend $4,000 maybe, or three on a chunk of bamboo with five holes in it. Because that art is still very much alive and has been for the, I think the instrument actually is only 300 or 400 years old, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, so this art died for a long time. The art of making these simple flutes, of course, as they came to the modern flute, and now, as people are becoming more and more interested in hearing the music, Bach and all of the other early music on with the sounds that the composers heard them, more and more people are coming to making these flutes. There was a blind flute player in Utrecht in Holland who was paid by the city, as so many musicians were in those days, to play the carillon. He was in charge of the bell tower in Utrecht, and also he serenaded the passers-by with flute music. And this is a copy of his book that was published actually in the early 1600s, but he was writing, this is in the early part of what we would call the Baroque period, but he was writing in an earlier style, in what very much is the Renaissance style. So these styles did very much overlap, just as today there are people that are writing and playing folk music that sounds like it's right out of the 60s. And other people are, some people in classical music are writing things that sound very atonal and like music that really was written by some in the 20s and earlier, and others are writing very melodic things. So these styles are not by any means clear cut. In any case, this is a little piece for the Renaissance flute by Jacob van Eyck, who was blind and who for the most part filled this book, or someone else who could see did, with familiar tunes of the days, including psalm tunes, which were what they often used in church. There's the setting of the Lord's Prayer in here with variations, or drinking songs or art song of the day, and then he would jazz it up with embellishments in the style of the time. So this is a little art song. I would read from the book, but this allows me to not have to turn the pages. And this is by the father of a friend of mine who was a sculptor in wood. This is a wood etching from someone in Germany. He lives in Hereford now, and well, his father passed away, this is a fun, nice wood etching of Bach. It happened to be a piece of scratch in my scratch paper pile. So this is Amarilli Mia Bella, which was a very well-known tune by then, by the 1630s. 1640s, and generally, in fact, they used tunes to embellish like this that were 30, 40, 50 years old. So the first time you hear the tune, and then it will become embellished more and more each time through. The door. These the Renaissance flutes, just like all of the Renaissance instruments, were in families. This is the small member of the family, the descant flute, and this one, a fifth higher, is the normal flute that they would play, just about the same size as any of these others. And I think the flutes are pretty much the same size, the usual flute that was played anyway through history, because this size of a flute has a sound that's especially like the human voice. And then there was a member of the family that was about this long, the bass flute, and often military men played them in consorts, and they had quivers. They had little quivers on their back with a hole for this size, and then one for this one, and a larger one, and they played them in groups like that in military music, not just a fife with a drum. That's fine. You just wonder how he did it, and you know, what sorts of expression he had. Obviously, if I were living or you were living in that time, then we all would have our own particular style, not only of playing this particular piece, but of making the embellishments ourselves. You know, he just made these things up on the spot, probably. Well, he was blind in the first place, but surely it wasn't quite that incredible. He surely, you know, did work some things out and remembered from time to time the same kinds of things that he did. It's quite something. There are hundreds of these tunes in here. It's really wonderful. Most people play them on recorder. Actually, very few people play the Renaissance flute, and when they do, there's one thing that is keeping people from really playing this, and that is people are making them so that they finger just like, they can be played just like a Baroque flute that came later. But in reality, the fingerings are completely different because these flutes, although they taper a little bit on the outside, are perfectly cylindrical on the inside. But this modern flute that you may have thought all this time is a perfect cylinder is not a perfect cylinder. It must have a conical shape to the top part. It must taper up to the top. And what that does is it corrects the octaves so that I can play the lower note and then la, then overblow, just blow harder, and I'll get that octave up here. Now, if I try that on this flute, it's quite flat, so I have to use completely different fingerings up there. Anyway, Rudy and I went down to Verona several times from Innsbruck to really be sure that we had this exactly right. And there are now a handful of people that are playing these flutes. This particular one is a flute that Rudy made again that is a copy of an instrument that was in Graz in Austria in a museum that actually has military things, fifes and drums and that sort of thing. That particular flute was stolen, although before it was, in the 1930s or 40s, the curator of the Musical Instrument Museum in Brussels made a copy of that flute in Graz, and this is a copy of that copy. Well then, this is, as I mentioned, the more normal size of the flute in those days. And I'd like to play a little piece by Giovanni Bassano, who played all sorts of wind instruments at the St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice. If you've ever been to Venice, you've surely seen it on the big square there, and it's just cavernous inside. A little flute can just fill it up like a chorus of trombones. And these pieces, Richer Cars, were sort of like written down improvisations. So this is one of those Richer Cars that Giovanni Bassano published in 1585. Thank you. what I especially enjoy, the literature that I especially enjoy on this is by Giovanni Bassano and others who wrote pieces similar to the Van Eyck, but they were embellishments on a well-known melody of an art song with the other parts as well. And well, they're really beautiful in the way they embellish or heighten the emotion of the piece. You know, when there's a particularly moving word in the piece, a flute can't express that word, but you can bring another touch of emotion by a flourish of notes all of a sudden. Around 1650 or 1680, they found that by putting this tapered part in the flute, you had an easier fingering system. You could, as I said, just overblow the octave and it would be pure. And so at first they put that tapered part down here in the body of the flute. And then, as you can see later, actually in the 1800s, actually very shortly before, as the modern flute was being developed, they put the tapered part in this top piece instead. So it doesn't really matter where it tapers. It has the same effect, whether it tapers in the body and this part is straight, cylindrical, or whether this is a cylinder and this part does. Some of the most famous first flute players were the hautetiers, and also there was another family, the philidors. In fact, there is a philidor chess move. Anyone who's a real chess master apparently these days knows the philidor move, which is one of the younger philidors who was very famous for his operas, but he was also a chess master. And he was born when his father was 69, and that particular father wrote in 1695 the earliest piece that I've ever come across. I happened to stumble on it in a collection of pieces in the Library of Congress that Philidor, who was the court musician to Louis XIV, dedicated to the Duke of Bavaria. It was a present for the Duke of Bavaria, and it says on the title page, to occupy, with the hopes that this will occupy some of your leisure time. And there were some beautiful engravings in it. And it was mostly pieces that were famous by some of the famous composers of the day. Lully was a very famous composer. Anyway, this little air for the German flute, which is what they call this, because if you just say flute, they generally thought of recorder, predates any other music that I know of for the transverse flute. This, though, is one of the first published pieces for flute, and this came along in 1708, already 100 years after the Baroque period began, although the flute, it's in its Baroque form, did come to a late beginning. And the little piece is called Echoes. Thank you. lot of this music that I'm playing is from the original edition. These have nifty little diamond notes, and the Von Eyck is interesting because it's the kind of print where there's one print block for every note. So you see that the staff is kind of like a dotted line, because there was the staff lines came along with the note on the print block. So there was, well, it's kind of interesting to see. Here it is in the original size and the blown up version for those of us who have to play this stuff. Unfortunately, they didn't have enlarging Xerox machines in those days. These booklets were surely the same size, and probably, well, maybe they reduced it, although I doubt it. And this was, instead of brown paper, it was surely nice leather with the gold letters. And in here, by the way, Von Eyck, he gives a picture of the recorder, and he says, "And this is how you play it." Isn't that fun? You all should go out and play these tunes. Here is the flute. And, well, instead of telling you how to play it now, I'll tell you in the next volume. And of course, the next volume never came out. So we don't have that, what otherwise would be, what would be very valuable information to have. Anyway, so also these, the Telemann fantasies I have here in the edition that might have been engraved by Telemann himself in about 1732 or so. Well, I'll play one of these fantasies by Telemann. This is the fifth one of a set of 12. And all of this music that I'm playing is meant to be played without any other instrument, just for unaccompanied flute. Thank you. a slightly later flute, maybe 1745 or so, made in Brussels. Again, a copy by Rudy. This is the only copy that I have that's not by Rudy. This is by Neidhart Busay in Berlin. And this is a copy of the kind of flute that Bach might have known. The makers, Jacob Denner was the son of also a famous instrument maker. They all ran in families. The Rottenbergs was a family of instrument makers, and the Hodeters also, and the Denners. But this fellow's father liked to go hunting a lot, and he also made recorders. Well, he stuck a end of a duck call on a recorder and invented the clarinet, by golly. But his son made oboes, and I think Jacob made also clarinets. I don't know if he did or not, but he surely made oboes and flutes. And this one is maybe from 1720 from Nuremberg, where they lived. And the original to this flute is still in a museum in Nuremberg. I'd love to go there, but I know they won't let me puff one little note on it. Some museums have that policy.
Is the white part, is that all wood, or is that originally ivory?
Well, this is ivory, and with every new, I'm a little bit embarrassed about that. Every new flute that I have has plastic on it. For instance, this has plastic, but still, and a lot of the instrument makers are turning to the plastic, but they are reluctant. Because for one thing, ivory turns beautifully on a lathe. It's just apparently much, much more fun to work with than the plastic is. And also the plastic has some problems in that it doesn't absorb any moisture, so it doesn't change with the wood. This plastic is separating in a couple of places from the wood slightly. It makes no difference, really, and next time I'm in Innsbruck, whenever that is, Rudy can fill it and fix it for me. But so the plastic has some difficulties there, whereas the ivory is a material that is porous, and it absorbs moisture and oil, and it does move with temperature and humidity, so it's less likely to separate from the wood. But, well, one thing that clinched it for me was at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, seeing the little display they have where they have the elephants, the little blinking light that blinks every time an elephant is killed, you know, in Africa, and they blink rather quickly. And of course, there is legal and illegal ivory, but in reality, a lot of the legal ivory is illegal ivory that's been channeled sneakily into the legal ivory thing. And besides, when you use legal ivory, you encourage people you encourage the illegal trade. So I really think.
Does fun work at all?
Well, I don't know, especially in large pieces like this, whether bone would work. Now, a flute like this does respond a little differently when you take off these massive ivory caps, or when you remove this chunk of ivory here. So the plastic that they would want to use would have to be fairly substantial in weight, and I think they've come up with some things.
What are all those different woods?
These are all ebony, and the preferred wood for flutes for many centuries was boxwood. And this is the same boxwood that you see in shrubs, especially in Virginia and, you know, in New England, I guess. But in Europe, there's a lot of it still that grows in trees, although it's hard to find. But back then, it was a lot easier to find. But a piece of boxwood that big will cost several hundred dollars, just because it is so rare and because boxwood grows so slowly and generally not very straight. So to get a chunk like that is quite something. Then they went to the harder woods later when they wanted a more brittle sound. Earlier with the Baroque flutes, they didn't want a harder wood like grenadilla This is African blackwood or granadilla, and this is coccus, Jamaican or Cuban coccus wood. Coccus is even harder than this, which is harder than both boxwood and ebony. But they like these for the later flutes because it does have a harder, a more brilliant sound. And then all of the rings are either ivory or plastic, and all of the hardware is silver. I'll just play one movement of the Bach piece for unaccompanied flute. Quick little piece by Quantz, who was the most famous flutist in the 18th century, mainly because, not only because he wrote the most well-known treatise on how to play the flute, which also has all kinds of practical information for all musicians, and particularly anyone today who is interested in performing early music. Anyway, he made several innovations. This is again a copy by Rudy of an instrument in the Library of Congress made by Quantz for Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, who introduced the potato to Germany, or at least its widespread use, and who was a wonderful flute player, Frederick the Great. Quantz divided this head joint into two pieces so that you could pull it out in the middle of the cylinder instead of pulling it out in order to tune right where the cylinder meets the cone, which causes all kinds of difficulty in the tone and the intonation. Also, he made a little screw device in the cap, which allows you to adjust where the cork is. And he added an extra key. In those days, there was not, for those of you who play and read music, there was not one note that's the same on the piano, say, for E flat and D sharp. They were two distinctly different notes. And when they were the same on the piano, it's because you had to make a compromise. That's why they had many different ways of tuning a harpsichord in those days, because they had to somehow compromise. And for some pieces, they wanted to put it more toward the E flat, and other pieces toward the D sharp. Well, with the flute, you can either correct by lipping up or down, or by using a slightly different fingering. But for the lowest possible note, you don't have those options, because your fingers are all closed, all used. So for this lowest key, which is usually an E flat or a D sharp, I forget which. Oh, it's raining. he put another hole that's slightly larger for the E flat, and the D sharp is a slightly smaller hole. Anyway, those were all Quantz's innovations, and this is a little caprice that Quantz wrote. Also, the bore of the flute is like a cannon bore compared to any of these other flutes, which throughout history have maintained a similar size of bore. He really opened that up because he wanted a very full sound, especially in the low register, but he sacrificed some of the high register sound. Somewhat of a thrill just to have your fingers right on the holes. That does make somewhat of a difference, and not all of the, you know, I could do it on this, I suppose. But there's a lot of clacking, and it's not quite as clear. It's louder. But yeah. So it's rather, you know, it's a very
like
fluid.
Like a manual typewriter to an electric or computer?
Yeah, something like that. In fact, I was thinking about computers just a second ago while I was playing that and looking at the notation in the telemon, and remarking that is the notation in the telemon is a hand engraving that looks a little bit more messy, and I was thinking that it's because it's an engraving that it looks more messy than this haut de terre, for instance. But no, that's actually an engraving too. In the early Baroque period, they had music that looked actually just like this Van Eyck, with the type, movable type for each note. And I thought, well, why didn't they just do engraving here too? Well, they did in some places, but they were so they thought, well, we've got printing for words, why not have it for music? And so they got all excited about it and made a note for, you know, a little block for each note and put it together. Well, then they finally decided, well, the heck with this, it looks too messy, let's just go back to some nice engraving. And so that's where we are now with computers. Now we've learned how to do computer it for word processing, and now they have it for music. And then maybe finally they'll say, well, the heck with this, let's just
write it up.
Yeah, actually it looks, it's in a way more satisfying to read from a manuscript than it is to read from just a...
printout.
But Jerry and I have one of these computer printouts for this piece that we're going to play tomorrow. Bob has all that equipment where you just write from the composing. You immediately have something that looks published. It's really quite something.
How do you spell Phonyk?
Phonyk, V-A-N, capital E-Y-K.
Are there breath notations in there?
No, you have to just sort of make your own choices. Actually, the Bassano, a friend of mine, had the microfilm of the first engraving, which he transcribed out into music, and then I just wrote this out in the transpositions that you need for flute. So that's not an authentic one. So next, I have finally something with a little more to keep my fingers company, I suppose, something to rattle and, you know, make me feel secure. actually, this one does rattle a bit. You'll hear it clacking somewhat. They said in those days to put some olive oil between the metal. It's metal on metal, little metal plugs that go into little metal receptacle. They say to put just a drop of olive oil, and in fact it does work. I meant to go to the kitchen and get some, but I forgot. Anyway, these are pads, just like the lower keys on the Baroque flutes were. So we're into the classical period now, about the time of Mozart. The Quantz flute dates from maybe 1750. So this whole period of Baroque flutes, of the four that I've played, the whole history of Baroque flutes is only 70 years or so, from 1680 to 1750. And then the whole period of these early keyed flutes is from 1770, really. They didn't get off the ball until then, although there was classical music, what we would call classical music a little earlier, until, 1845, when this was invented. So that's, 75 years or so. And yet this was invented in 1845 and is still around, so this thing is much more ancient than some of these were in their day. This is already 45 years old.
Was the transfer made from wood to silver looking for more brilliance in the sun?
Yes.
Or was it?
Yeah, it couldn't have been, yes, and it wouldn't have worked with this kind of a flute with the small holes. It sounds just too tinny. You really need the wood here. Some people play modern flutes just like this, but with a wooden body. So it's all entirely made out of wood. This lip plate is sometimes carved out of wood, or it's thick enough here that the whole thing is one thick piece and there's just a hole. And then you just have the silver keys. And in fact, my teacher at the University of Washington, Felix Skowronek, he still plays these wooden keys.